everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 4, Episode 15, Oi to the World. I was going to complain about that, but then I remembered the name of our podcast. And now, here are your hosts.
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Before we get into this holiday episode, let us talk about what's coming up on the Patreon. Again with this, episode 67 is dropping October 8th. Let's watch Brian Austin Green in Circus of the Stars. Right now in our timeline, he's on Dancing with the Stars with his girlfriend, Sharna. Grateful for Sharna. But in 1988, he was in the 13th annual Circus of the Stars special on CBS. And originally when I picked this, it was just a clip of the first 20 minutes, which ends with Brian Austin Green's segment. But then when I went to watch this on Friday night, I found the entire thing, including the 1988 ads. Like, it's the full 2 hours,
man.
In all its glory. So we'll link both of those in the show notes. But yeah, it's quite something. He does tumbling.
I really know so much about his anatomy that
yep.
It is illegal for me to know.
He's a little baby boy. He's 14 when this mm-hmm. happens. And
it's like the best his hair looked
yeah.
in that timeline also, which mm-hmm. is weird. And then there's O.J. Simpson. It's a lot. We're talking about most of it.
It's a lot. And other stars from the Starverse as well. So, yeah, we'll get into it. So mm-hmm. I also forgot to mention this up top in our last episode, although Sarah did mention it in the outro. Thank you, Sarah. Grateful for Sarah. Our latest supersized Again With Them, which is our monthly digest of the most recent month's worth of episodes of Jenny and Tori's recap podcast 90210 and G, Will dropped last week. The first one and then the other did not show up for it. And then Sissany was out on mat leave and apparently is going to be out until November. So.
Until November. Right.
That's what she says.
On the advice of counsel. Until November.
So they fill with an assortment of guest co-hosts that are, and I do not use this word lightly, extremely chaotic. If
oh,
you've
God,
been waiting
yeah.
to up your pledge or to join the Patreon, truly now is the time to hear the breakdown on that. I don't even want to spoil any of it because it's so wild. But
breakdown is really an apt word for a number of reasons, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. So Again With Them is a perk for our Patreons at the $5 level and up, and it gets you also access to all previous episodes of the Again With This and all previous Again With Thems. And that is at patreon.com/againwiththis. Now, let's get into this episode, Oi to the World. Starting with our C-plot, Matt and his love interest are part of this episode, really. Not so much a part that we have any clips for it, but they are.
I mean, oh my God, this whole thing is like, it's fine that we don't have any clips. They wouldn't help.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the editors clipped out a lot of relevant plotting of this and left it, and it's like, you know, meanwhile in another part of the desert, and then
right.
it's just like, he still exists, like, why are, what
mm-hmm.
and they only put like the climactic moments in throughout this whole storyline, so yeah, it's a problem. They still don't know what to do with Matt. Sigh.
Yeah. We open this plotline at Shooters, where the place is buzzing. The stock room is crammed with inventory. Jake curtly tells Matt he placed a double order to get them through New Year's. Because remember, he took out a loan from a loan shark. They are behind the bar working when Matt decides the time is right to thank Jake for giving him a job when he needed it, but he's quitting because he doesn't feel right knowing his paycheck is going to be a strain on Jake's finances. And Jake tries to laugh this off, but Matt, and Matt alone apparently, knows what Shelley did to Jake.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake sort of jovially says that if the day comes when he can't pay Matt, he's bankrupt, which, yeah. I believe that's Matt's point. But anyway, he appreciates the offer, but he handled his money problems last week. And Matt is like, how? And Jake is like, don't worry about it. So remember Alan, the actor in the real ugly vest, he is out with Matt. Chatting on the sidewalk about knowing he was gay after playing Tony in West Side Story and not being interested in his Maria. Truly, the gayest gay origin story ever, by the way.
I think someone just, had Google been invented by that time? I don't know. I guess mm-hmm. they Netscaped it and were like, what's a gay origin story?
Yeah.
This one.
Yep.
Sigh.
Yes. It was like this or Godspell, maybe. But anyway, Matt knew he was gay when he was 10, but didn't do anything about it until he was 18. Convenient, legal. Mm. He did, however, come out at his senior prom when he declined to go to some cabin afterward, and a jock was bullyingly like, what are you, gay? And Matt was like, yes. Next stop, Shooters, where Matt gets an employee discount on drinks. And turns out Jake subscribes to the Nat Busiccio School of Business and gives Matt and Alan their first beers for free.
Guys.
I mean, it is the holidays. Maybe Jake's like, I didn't get you anything. I got you those beers. Alan comments that it's been a while since he's dated someone on a regular basis. Matt kind of rudely asks if two dates qualifies as regular, which, like, they do for you, my friend, but...
Yeah, really, don't... yeah.
And apparently for Alan as well. Maybe they should talk about it back at Matt's place, but whatever transpires there, we don't see it, and that's where we leave these two plus Jake for now. We have more to discuss, but first, we have a message for Erica.
Erica's sister Alexa let us know that Erica was the one who first directed Alexa to this podcast. Though they live far apart and on opposite sides of the border, having the podcast in common is one of the ways they stay connected. Aw.
Erica continues to live in the sister's home state of Connecticut, so in honor of Erica's birthday this week, we made a list of 5 points of interest in the Nutmeg State and the Starverse character to whom they would be most relevant.
Number one. Connecticut's Scoville Library, established in 1771, is the oldest publicly funded library in the country. We would love to get Billy Campbell there to check out some books and prove to us that he knows how to read.
Number two, the headquarters of World Wrestling Entertainment is located in Stamford, Connecticut, and we feel the stunt double who fell down the stairs in Tori Spelling's place in the season 5 finale should see Gross. If they have any openings, because he may have a great career ahead of him as a wrestler.
Mm. Number three. Connecticut was the first state to impose a speed limit on motorists. Originally, that was 12 miles an hour, which we think is just about what Brenda was doing when she rear-ended that grifter.
Remember that. Number mm-hmm. four, Connecticut has the highest per capita income of any state in the union, and if someone tells Brooke that, she might move there.
And number five, Hartford, Connecticut is the insurance capital of the world. But even if she went door-to-door begging for a deal, Amanda still probably pays record-high premiums to cover Melrose Place.
On behalf of Alexa and all of us, happy birthday,
happy
Erica!
Happy birthday, Erica!
And now our B-plot. Speaking of Brooke, Brooke's soap opera pregnancy meets an extremely predictable fate. Oh, boy. So... We pick back up with Allison and Billy in Santa Barbara as she weeps on his shoulder about how lonely she's been. She had secretly hoped Haley was just faking his death. And honestly, she's not wrong to think that's a possibility.
She's really not.
But the divorce news wrecked her because believing that Haley loved her was all she had left. And she grabs the vodka bottle again as Billy scolds that she told Amanda she could handle this account. And Allison defensively says the presentation isn't until the next day, and all she's missed so far is lunch with some anal clients. And again, drunk Allison, undefeated.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Merry Christmas to us.
Mm-hmm. Billy snits that those clients have been trying to figure out where Allison was. So it was lucky he picked up the call. No, he didn't. The receptionist did and told him about it after she hung up. But the facts don't matter as much as drunk Allison's contempt for Billy. Clip two.
Oh. And the amazing Billy rode to Allison's rescue. Spare me.
You're killing your career.
I don't care, Billy. My husband is dead. I finally let myself love someone again, and then Haley cuts himself out of my life. And when I needed you, Brooke was stuck to your side like a damn tattoo.
Because she was grieving.
Until her $1 million inheritance cheered her up. She's so damn superficial. She still blames me for everything Haley did. And you stand right next to her. Like it really was my fault.
Brooke didn't get you drunk. And this fiasco is your fault.
Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The library's open.
Yeah, he's not wrong, but like, appreciate the points she is making, particularly you stand at her side, because true.
Yeah. And also, why are you here? Like, never has there been a worse pairing of actor and like ambiguous feeling in soap operas than Shu and this. But here we all are, struggling to understand what he's doing.
So this is when Allison downshifts to horniness and presses herself against Billy, saying their love is still special and can't he be the one person in her life who doesn't lie to her, even if it's only for one night? And seems like Billy agrees as he picks her up in his arms, walks her into the shower, then turns on the water and leaves, which you can see in the visual aids. Because he enjoys doing it, and I think Courtney Thorne-Smith enjoys playing her shock that she's standing in a shower alone, getting water sprayed on her in her robe.
For sure.
The next day, Brooke interrupts Amanda trying to fuck Peter the first thing in the morning. We will get to them. To yell at her for sending Bruce, he came up in the ad, sending Billy to Santa Barbara after Allison, which Amanda definitely did not do. We watched Billy decide to go all on his own, but it doesn't matter because Amanda's response to Brooke is say, yes, I did, and try and slam the door in her face, but Brooke kicks it back open to continue yelling about the plans that Amanda ruined, as if Amanda gives a fuck, during the course of which Amanda confirms that Billy does not have clients in Santa Barbara, but Allison does. And this is news to Brooke, but Amanda does not care about throwing a grenade at their marriage and ushers Brooke back out. Back to Santa Barbara, where an already showered and dressed Billy opens the blinds next to a moaning, very hungover Allison. Seeing what he's doing, she bitches that she can pack her own briefcase, but actually he's taking the meeting in her place because she's a mess and her clients know her addiction history. And Allison vaguely says she'll go back to AA, but Billy is unmoved and tells her to sleep it off. And she's mad instead of being like, woo, snow day, like I would. And apparently that's like, no spoilers for the rest of the episodes, really, but like her saying, I'll go back to AA is the end of this bender. Like, it doesn't come up again.
Yeah.
Okay.
One day at a time.
Sure.
That's how it works.
That's true. Thank God we don't have to see Billy trying to blunder through this meeting and instead return to all these idiots as Allison has just gotten out of the shower to find Brooke at the door, accusing her of inventing a client meeting to get Billy there and fuck him. Allison denies it. Does this shut Brooke up? Of course not. And then the conversation really takes a turn. Clip three.
First you seduce my father, then you kill him. 2 weeks later, you're after my husband.
Too bad you don't have a brother. It's a joke, Brooke. Nothing happened. Your precious Billy is still your precious Billy.
Why should I believe anything you say? You're such a perverted bitch.
Yeah, it's a gift.
How dare you patronize me?
Well, then give me a choice, Brooke. You storm in here completely irrational, making ludicrous accusations.
What's going on?
You tell me. One room, one night, one man, one slut. If it isn't an affair, what is it?
Okay, I won't lie to you. Allison and I were together last night.
What? Damn you. How could you do this to me? You promised not Allison. I'm pregnant. We're having a baby. Can't believe this.
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Well, now that we have the truth, what does this affair mean?
Nothing. It was one night and a big mistake. I don't want to see you again, Allison. And I just risked everything for one empty moment. So from now on, just stay out of our lives.
Take me home now. Are you nuts?
Yeah, I think so. Put my whole marriage on the line for your career, so don't blow it.
I have so many notes. Would you like to start?
Go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I LOL'd when I first watched that scene for the first of several times. This is now my grand unifying theory of Christmas time episodes, because I laughed a bunch of times at that Dawson's episode, like season four, where like Dawson was getting good lines, and I was like, it's not the Christmas spirit on my part, so are the writers okay?
Yeah.
They just think nobody's going to be watching. Like, nobody's going to be home. They're all going to be out at Christmas parties, so they'll just write whatever, and it's actually better that way.
Yeah.
So there's that. Second of all, Andrew Hsu is not the only one who I think is not totally sure, like, that the road is being built under the character while he's driving on
right.
the road.
Right.
Because
yes. yeah.
Kristen Davis's delivery is very weird here, and it reminded me of that rant she goes on in Sex and the City, where she's like, I've been dating since I was 15. Where is he?
Yeah.
I mean, it just made me laugh. But also, what the fuck is going on, Tara? Seriously, like, what is Billy's plan?
I
don't get it.
I don't either. Like, I don't understand if he just... the only thing I can think is that if he decided in the moment, like, I could deny it, but it doesn't matter. Like, she's not going to believe me even if I do. So I might as well just see how she reacts to this. The other thing is that, I mean, the next scene, it sort of seems like what he was hoping for is that she would be like, I can't believe you cheated on me. It's over. And then, spoiler, she's not. And then he's like, well, great. So, it's not clear to me.
Yeah. I mean, and it, like, it's sort of, it's, we have to infer that that's the plan on the writer's part based on later scenes, which we'll get to. But it's like, there was a way to let the other actors do what they always have to do, which is like indicate in the space left by Andrew Hsu's loggishness. And that did not happen. It really felt like even Courtney Thorne Smith was like, wait, did I get these pages? What? Because she, you know, can actually act. And
yes.
So, yeah, I don't, it's hard to tell what's going on, but I guess we'll all find out together.
Yeah. I mean, the other stuff then happens to undercut my theory that he was deliberately trying to basically dare Brooke to dump him. That like, if that's the case, then later scenes don't bear that out at all. And not only because of how he's acting, but just like how it's written too.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It is very weird.
So let's get to those later scenes. The next morning, Brooke is quietly seething in the apartment, but Billy confronts the situation he has invented head on, asking Brooke, perhaps hopefully, if she's going to leave him. But she won't sacrifice their marriage over a one-night stand, and you'd think that he would be like, well, fuck. But as usual, Andrew Hsu's expression is completely wrong for that, as you can see in the visual aids. So she goes on, she will only tolerate one affair, and he burned his on Allison. And Billy wants to know how Brooke can be so cold about this, but she doesn't have the option of flipping out about him. She's pregnant, and clip four.
And worst of all, I love you.
Yeah, that truly is worst of all.
It is. Especially in this scene, it comes off as like they're, I don't know, like kink role play. Because of both his facial expressions and her being like, I have nothing to react to, so I'm just going to say the lines and go home.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Billy claims he loves her too and was up all night worried that he had destroyed everything. Their family is important to him and he'll be a good father and husband now. And Brooke whines a request that they move away because she hates this place and all their neighbors, which, fair. He will only agree to talk about it, but she says she found a great place while he was gone and he looks forward to seeing it, you know, and ruling on it, I guess. But surprise, she already bought it. And she can forgive, but she never forgets. And if he cheats on her again, he'll never see his baby, which that's true. He was right about talking it out. She feels so much better. And she leaves the room and Andrew Hsu vaguely smiles in a way that tells us nothing about how Billy is supposed to
be
feeling.
If you're watching this scene on mute, you would think that she thought she screwed him in their fantasy football draft, but he knows he screwed her in their fantasy football draft.
Yes, exactly. Onward to another scene that disproves the theory that Billy was trying to tank his marriage. He gets back to the complex that night as Allison is struggling to get a box up the stairs because obviously she had to move out of the manor and Amanda rented Allison, Billy, and Brooke's old place upstairs. And she defensively tries to preempt his objections, but he doesn't care and tells her about the house that he and Brooke are going to be moving to soon. And Allison correctly assumes that Brooke took the money for it out of the baby's trust fund. Clip five.
It's none of your business. You just don't understand my relationship with Brooke.
No one does.
Give me a break.
Want to know the truth? I didn't sleep with you because I didn't want to.
In AA, we call that denial.
Well, I won't deny that I'm married. I'm going to do whatever it takes to be right there for my child. Not going to be a
sick joke of a parent like your father. Definitely not like Haley.
Oh, that's nice. A good father in a loveless marriage. You think a kid doesn't pick up on that?
If Brooke and I have any trouble, it's because I spend all my time worrying about you. You know, you go blind and I want to help. Your husband dies and I feel bad. But that's all we have left, is my worry and my guilt. And I can't do it anymore, Allison, all right? I won't give up my family and my happiness just because your life's a damn mess.
Fine, Billy. You keep trying to convince yourself it's my fault you don't love your wife. Oh, and for the record, you didn't want to sleep with me? Bull.
I mean, he might have not wanted to sleep with you because you were extremely drunk and yikes. But other than that, like, bringing up her father, like, to say he's going to be a better dad than him is, like, real yikes.
Yeah. Like, and not something you give to Andrew Shue to do.
No.
Like, if you're going to do it at all, don't, but not him.
Right. But also, it just seems like someone showing off, like, hey, I finally got around to season two.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Anyway, he responds to this parting shot by pulling Allison's box down the stairs, like, okay, grown up. And then we're at the hospital where Brooke's doctor is telling her the test was negative. Clip six.
Oh, God, no. It can't be. I had a miscarriage.
I'm afraid you were never pregnant. The lab traced the problem to technician error. Apparently, your sample was switched with another.
I don't understand. The first test was positive. I've been fighting morning sickness for weeks.
It's rare, but it does happen. You wanted a baby so much, your body created physical symptoms.
It's not true.
I know this is very upsetting. If you'd like to talk to someone, I can recommend a good therapist.
That won't be necessary.
Perhaps you'd like me to explain this situation to your husband.
No.
Nurse Lily from ER, everybody. Went to med school, now a doctor.
Anyway, obviously, we know the reason why Brooke doesn't want anyone to tell this to Billy, but also he already thinks Brooke is mentally ill, so, you know, this wouldn't faze him at all, even if she told him the truth, which she obviously is not going to do. And when Brooke gets home, she's moved to see that Billy put up the tree while she was gone. He knows it's early, but he couldn't resist getting things for the baby. He also has one gift to give her now. It's a locket with their wedding photo on one side and space in the other for the baby's photo. It's nothing compared to the gift she's carrying, of course. And as predicted, Brooke does not tell him anything and just sobs on his shoulder. Like, there's not even the, I have something to tell you. Wait, I have to tell you first, because she was never going to say anything.
Yeah, what were you going to say? Never mind. Uh-huh. So thank you for not doing that. But again, here, Andrew Shue's quote acting leaves the door open more than a crack for the possibility that he knows already.
Right.
She's not really pregnant, but that doesn't make sense either.
No, we know, and we know from the next episode, again, spoiler, that he doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, he just took her at her word. The only surprise to me in this storyline is that she legitimately really thought she was pregnant, and the fact that she isn't is not her fault.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Finally, our A-plot. Literally no part of Jane's life is going well, but Amanda stays above the fray. After some holiday B-roll, a mix of footage we have seen before and some new, we join Amanda in bed, getting ready to roll on to Peter, who protests that it's 6 a.m. She's hot, but I am with him, obviously. That's too early. She wants some quality time before he leaves for golf with Bobby. He is ready to cancel that, but she scolds that he promised Bobby he would go, and we're supposed to think Peter only invited Bobby on Amanda's urging, even though when we last saw them, they were toasting at Shooters like buddies. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah.
She further exposits that Bobby is the good Parisi. Even the FBI couldn't find anything on him. They're just getting down to fucking when there's a knock at the door. It's Brooke. We already talked about her. And when Amanda turns back around after dismissing Brooke, she's dismayed to see Peter putting clothes on because he's not in the mood anymore, but she very easily changes his mind back again because, obviously. At the studio, Jane is asking Joe for design advice. Joe notes that this is a change from Jane being a bitch to her for weeks. I'm paraphrasing. But Jane says that working there has been a rough road, and Jane can't hate Joe forever for liking Richard. She doesn't want her jealousy to destroy the second chance that Richard gave her. And no sooner has Jane expressed her wish to make things up to Richard and Joe does Richard himself come call Jane into his office. And at this point, again, motivation-wise, it seems like this is legit. Like, Jane actually is thinking, like, I should just accept how things are and quit doing all of what I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, not as much in this episode, but in the next episode, like, Amanda's whole affect is, like, a little bit weird to me. Like, we'll talk about it more, but there are just certain line deliveries where it's like, now she's sort of all in sex kitten mode and like, you know, I love Peter and everything's fine and we're a super couple and it's like something is off there. I can't quite put my finger on what it is and it's not Locklear's issue, but there's like just a lot of weird vague writing that sometimes the actors make a decision and sell whatever it is they think is happening, but other times it's like, where, like, are you just sort of randomly pivoting people in a bunch of directions before February sweeps?
Hard I was going to say, yeah, we're halfway through the season. So it could just be like, we have to start, like, we have to tilt the dial this way instead of that way.
So
people don't get bored for both of these blondes. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So in his office, Jane tries to apologize to Richard as well, but he stops her to smile smugly as he says he's always wanted to start a company of his own. But before he can ruin Jane's life, Joe pokes her head in. And when Jane is left, Joe says they can't kick Jane out of the company now. The press framing will be that Richard has dumped Jane in business and love, which I refuse to believe this is a universe where the press gives fuck one about the company or the relationship. Sorry.
Well, really. Also, waiting until after Christmas does not help.
No, it doesn't. Richard doesn't think the romance part is a problem since Jane can't shut up about Michael. And Joe pleads that Jane has been traumatized by her own company's bankruptcy. Chris alert. Clip 7.
The contracts are drawn. We've already opened new accounts.
Please. I mean, it's almost Christmas.
Christmas? Hey.
So Richard just fondly tells Joe she's something else or whatever, like he's giving in, which, like, sure, which, you know, if this contract is about booting Jane, then what difference does it make that he has new deals in place? He will still have them once Jane is not in the company anymore.
Yeah. And then he just puts them in a cabinet as though that does something filings wise, which is funny to me.
Right. So I do see Joe's point about waiting until after the New Year to do it, I guess. And I only say that as someone who was laid off from a job on December 3rd. So,
yeah.
Joe kisses her thanks, and Richard notes that Jane will never know what a gift Joe just gave her. Over to the collateral damage from Jane's little gambit. Sydney and her latest weird outfit, a matching, I can't tell if it's a sweater and skirt set or if it's just a sweater dress.
I think it's a sweater dress and like the Brady Bunch style with that belt that makes it look like it's a skirt. Yeah.
Anyway, so the visual aids. They're lying on the couch in Kimberly's office, recapping her attempt to open the relationship the other night. After we left them, Michael apparently threatened to kick Sydney out of the beach house. Kimberly is serene. Clip 8.
Sydney, no matter what Michael says, he doesn't want you to leave. You're what Jane can never be. Perfect doctor's wife.
I am trying. I am in his face all day, at home, at the office. He just won't let me into his life.
You need to focus. Think, Sydney. What do you have in common?
2 weeks ago, I'd say it was hating you. No offense.
What you have in common is Michael's career. You want him to succeed.
Yeah, but it's hard when Peter keeps stealing the limelight. Michael works his butt off, and then Peter gets the huge donation from Bobby Parisi. Michael goes completely nuts, and then he takes it all out on me.
Michael's not satisfied with being a good doctor. He wants power and prestige. You could help him get it.
Right. My real name is Jeannie, and I live in a bottle.
Please don't start dressing like that now, on top of everything
God.
Else.
I'd almost rather see that, as usual in this episode, and you'll see it in the visual aids. There's like one outfit in this style that really works and is cute.
Yep.
And then the rest are bonkers and the hair bows are, it's just like kudzu. They're everywhere. Yes. They won't stop.
Yeah. So Kimberly is thinking about Sydney positioning herself as Michael's first lady, basically. There's a hospital Christmas party coming up, and Sydney should volunteer to step in for the ailing chairwoman, which, if there's a chair, there's a committee. One of those broads definitely has already replaced whoever this lady is.
Mm. This is really the point at which they start sort of steering into full-on soap opera tropes, including the fact that in both daytime and nighttime soaps, like, there is always some kind of charity benefit that is the excuse for, and this is true on Real Housewives franchises, actually, now that I think about it, that is the excuse to have everybody in the same place.
Yes.
And some of the resulting props are really, really keepers, as we'll see.
So Kimberly tells Sydney to make the party so special that Michael can't forget it. Sydney is full of self-doubt, but Kimberly counters that it could be a huge success that makes stars of Sydney and Michael. And while Sydney thinks about it, Kimberly announces that she's prescribing Sydney some tranquilizers she should take before bed. So put a pin in that. Over to the Burns and Mancini offices, where Michael is sorting the million messages Bobby has apparently left for Peter and whining about Bobby's big donation making Peter look good. Clip 9.
Bobby is a transparent leech.
And we'll count your blessings. My leech has red hair and thinks she's Marla Trump.
Drink.
Did she ever go by that name? I don't think she did.
I don't think she did either. I think they were only really married for like 10 minutes. So
yeah. It's crazy that we're still in that period. But anyway, Peter's like, hey, yeah, where is Sydney? And Michael says he sent her to wash his car. And then Bobby himself is there wanting to take Peter to lunch. Peter's booked, but Michael heartily volunteers to go instead and mentions that he and Peter once saved a patient together. Amanda, that's one way to explain what happened. And then Sydney's back, quelling about running the hospital fundraiser on Christmas Eve, a date when such a thing would never happen, by the way. Mm-hmm. Just would not. Sydney and Bobby are introduced, and then she starts chattering on about the party while Michael and Peter look exhausted by her. Clip 10.
Peter, I need a big favor. I want this party to be kick butt, so I was thinking maybe I could borrow your house.
No.
Oh. Well, thanks for your support.
You know, Sydney, if it's a fundraiser, I'd be willing to offer my home. I just leased a house in Hancock Park.
Well, that's very uptown.
No offense, but no thanks.
Sydney, stop proving you're a nut bar. She'll take it.
Good. My staff is at your disposal, Sydney. I'm always willing to help a worthy cause.
You have a staff?
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, why don't you just have the fundraiser in his suit coat? Mm-hmm. Because there's plenty of room.
Anyway, once that's taken care of, Michael hustles Bobby out, laying on the ethnic charm. Clip 11.
Come on, Parisi, your Paisan Mancini's going to take you to the best Italian kitchen in town.
Good. You drive, I'll buy. See you, Peter. Sydney.
There goes a frightening picture.
It's so true. I must salute Jack Wagner, who is having a ball playing Peter's, like, just in the next few episodes, Peter's just like beleaguered, and Jack Wagner is playing it perfectly. He's so funny. And also, the idea that Bobby's like, I just want to have lunch with someone, anyone, you'll do.
Yeah.
And they just go and eat Man of God is, I don't know. This show, like, I really think they thought nobody was watching, so they just did whatever. And it's not the worst. It's working
it's really
on me.
Not. Over to the empty studio. Allison trails Jane, expositing that Jane is still working Michael to get at Richard. Jane wants to show Allison the dresses she's picked out for the hospital party and ends up in Richard's office. And for some reason, goes straight to the cabinet where he had left the partnership dissolution paperwork. Like, it's not like she saw him put it there, so this makes no sense. If she's looking for a key to the room that's locked, like, that's not where people keep office keys.
No.
Go to the top drawer of the desk.
It would be in the Scott Scanlon drawer, is A. And B, exactly. There was nothing else in there but a phone book, which she would know.
Yeah.
But sure.
So she immediately curses Joe out for taking everything in Jane's life. And then over to Amanda's, where she hears the door and calls for Peter to come in. But it's not Peter. It's two FBI agents. They just heard from colleagues in the Miami office who think she's dead. Hey, is that the same FBI that couldn't identify well-known character actor Jay Johnston, allegedly, from a pretty clear photo at the Capitol on January 6th? That scans.
Mm.
One guy recaps, leave it to the professionals, Amanda's recent encounters with law enforcement in terms of her dad's death and Jack's, and they advise her that she reconsider her friendship with Bobby. She notes that if they had anything on him, they would have arrested him so they can go harass someone else. But when they leave, she looks stricken. We have more on this plot line, alas. But first, a message from Andy.
Andy writes, my partner's name is Rage, for Rachel, and her birthday is on October 4th. We are huge Melrose fans and are currently suffering, truly, through the last three seasons of BH90210 and despise the gang more than anything. Mm-hmm. Legit. I think Donna is legitimately the worst, most contemptible TV character of all time. Anyway, my idea for a top five is the top five ways that the BH gang would have died already if they lived in Melrose Place, and the reason this is a fitting birthday list is because of the joy this alternative reality can impart to all of us for a brief time. End quote. Well, Andy and Rage, you've earned that. So, without further ado, the top five ways the Bev Niners would have died already if they lived in the MP complex.
Number one, Kelly, knocked out at her own birthday party by diet pills, taken to Wilshire Memorial, where her treating physician is fatally Michael Mancini.
Number two, David is DJing a booze cruise on Jake's boat when it blows up. His XXXXL attire becomes a sheet of fire and he burns to a tiny, piss-faced cinder.
Number three, whilst driving drunk, Brandon T-bones Michael and Kimberly's car. True, Michael was also drunk, but Kimberly's vengeance upon Brandon is far more easily accomplished as she's able to step on him like a wee bug and kill him instantly.
Number four, Dylan and Kelly are enjoying that notorious freezing cold pool makeout sesh at Melrose instead of at the Bellage when Billy drops an armload of plugged-in Christmas lights into the pool. Bzzzt, this couple is never again.
And finally, number five, Donna follows a fawn into the basement of the complex seconds before Kimberly's bomb goes off. The fawn, sheltering behind an industrial washing machine, is fine. Donna gets picked up with a sponge.
We hope these Darwin Award-worthy deaths bring joy to both of you. And to Rage, whose name we experience so often in connection with these shows,
happy birthday! So the next time we head to the Burns Mancini office, it's been overtaken by Christmas shit for the holiday party, plus a huge sign with a giant headshot promoting Michael as a special guest speaker. Just what every Christmas Eve office party needs, a speaker.
Although this will be a Christmas present for Tara if I can find it, and I am going to try.
This is the first Michael has heard about a speech he's supposed to give, but he's impressed that Sydney did all this for him, but then demands the cash he asked her to get him. She unwisely hands him her whole bag to fish it out, which is when he finds the tranquilizers. She doesn't see the problem, so he hustles her into his office, not by the arm, but shoving her, basically, by the back, to yell at her for letting Kimberly treat her and thus telling Kimberly shit about him, he assumes correctly. Sydney protests that Kimberly's really helping her. Thanks to Kimberly, their life is going to be wonderful, but Michael is not so sure. And goes straight to Kimberly at the hospital. She's now walking around in a lab coat, as psychiatrists normally do of a day, to yell at her about Sydney. She wins the conversation by staying calm, including when he threatens to unscrew the plate in her head, which she only has because you drove her while drunk, so I personally would not remind her about it if I were you, sir. Then Amanda finds Bobby at his place as his staff sets up the hospital party. She wants him to bring his account back to D&D and tells him about the Fed's visit. He is sorry she got dragged into it, but she's defiant, since she's pretty sure the FBI is out to get her now, too. She and Bobby both know how hard it is to start over amid other people's prejudice, and she is sick of being pushed around. She believes in Bobby. And then he's back in.
Okay.
The next morning, Allison is weeping at It's a Wonderful Life when Jane enters, dressed all fancy for the party that she's decided to attend after all, and also has a dress for Allison. And then it's that night, and Peter arrives at Amanda's in time to zip her dress, and he's like, up or down? We're supposed to believe he got all dressed in his tux to come over and tell her he didn't want to go? Doubtful.
Yeah, no.
Amanda isn't interested in his bullshit either way, telling him about working on Bobby's account again. And if Peter doesn't want to go to promote his career, they can go to promote hers. To hospital people? Why? Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. It can also be late, she adds suggestively. He snits that she can't just kiss her way out of this, but she's pretty sure she can and is correct. And at the party, Sydney, in one of the better outfits other than the gloves, I thought, it's like a black lace clingy dress and black satin gloves for no reason. Anyway, she's getting showered with compliments and loving it until Michael spots Jane and takes off to greet her. And in his absence, Bobby comes over with more praise. Sydney thanks him for the use of his house. And he asks why she was so reluctant, and in a adoy tone, she says she knows that Bobby is Amanda's mobster, which, rude under the circumstances.
Yeah, right?
But he denies it, and she promises his secret is safe with her. Outside, Peter and Amanda pull up and are immediately papped by the feds. She storms over to smash their camera, and the main agent, Morrow, has just threatened her with jail time when Peter comes over to intervene, and as they're walking off, Amanda tries to avoid explaining how he knows their names. Inside, Richard and Joe mock Jane for working the room. Allison anemically tries to defend Jane before just walking away instead and not telling them she knows about Richard's contract, which, like, oh, someone on the show can keep a secret. Interesting.
Or the writers forgot that she knew that. Waps.
Yeah. One or the other, for sure. Then Peter finds Bobby out by the pool. There's some unremarkable posturing before Peter growls that if Bobby cared about Amanda, he wouldn't drag her back into his life. Back inside, Sydney is mopily watching Michael and Jane dance before grabbing a glass of champagne off a passing tray. Eventually, she gets her tranquilizers out of her purse, dumps the contents of two in her glass, and to herself mutters that it's time for Jane's nap. And you can see the visual aids. There's a shot of, like, Joe dancing with Richard, making a really weird face for no reason. Just seems like she's trying to maximize her tiny amount of,
of time. Yeah.
On screen. When we rejoin the Mancinis, Michael's trying to beg off another number, but Jane says she's just getting warmed up. And isn't that how Michael wants her? Warmed up? And apparently he does. And Sydney is scowling watching them go upstairs when Kimberly rolls up to tell Sydney what a great party it is. Sydney thanks her and then is like, are there any side effects to those pills you prescribed? Which, like, no, she hasn't had any problems, just wondering.
Oh, well, people's reactions vary. Some people fall asleep just looking at the bottle, and others feel the opposite effect. They can get very hyper. And I wouldn't advise you taking one tonight. With the amount of champagne you've had, any reaction would be very severe.
I won't. Thanks.
Then it's time for a presentation, but Michael and Jane are going to miss it because they're upstairs in the guest room where Jane is ripping off her clothes and Michael's. And downstairs, Sydney is very proud to say the Wilshire Memorial Scholarship is going to be presented by her very special personal physician, Michael, except it won't because he's upstairs trying to figure out if Jane has passed out or clip 14.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, I killed her.
I present Dr. Michael Mancini.
Help! Somebody dial 911!
Oh my God.
And that's it. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, what the hell?
So let's close it up by naming our episode MVP. Kimberly, because if she orchestrated all that to make Michael look a fool, she did it perfectly.
I don't know. I'm going to say Allison spoke truth to power and managed to keep a secret, even if it was because the writers just forgot that she knew. Still, good for you.
And didn't have to sleep with Billy again. The best part. Least valuable player. Matt, it's sad. I mean, I know he's happy and we should be happy for him, and I am in a sense, but also they're skipping so many stages in this plot line and really giving him such short shrift.
Yeah, and his hair looks terrible, but I'm still gonna go with Sydney. You can't be roofying people. It's just not okay.
Yeah, great point.
Every now and then I make one. Next time on Again With This, will Matt's feelings get trampled by yet another love interest? Will Jane regain feeling in her right side? And what exactly is Billy feeling in any given scene as his marriage to Brooke disintegrates? Hard to say. But we can say you'll feel your retinas disintegrating when you check out our visual aids. You'll find those for this and every other episode of Again With This at againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you can find links to our very special 90210 book. Or you could follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and join our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Any level of support gets you extra episodes. I'm Transparent Leech Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host thinks she's Marla Trump, but she's actually at Tara Ariano, and our producer is Worthy Cause David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
I am so sorry all this is happening to you.